Welcome to the Class of 1987 podcast. I am your host, Tim Harkness. On this podcast, we will be speaking with members of the Yale College Class of 1987 about their lives, where they've been, where they are now, and where they are going. We plan to cover a wide range of topics and have people who represent the full range of our class's experience. The class of 1987 is the best class that Yale College has ever had, and we're here to celebrate that. So sit back and listen to what your classmates have to say. Welcome to the next episode of the Y87 podcast. Today, we're going to be turning the tables. Our first guest, Melissa Bauman Ward, will be interviewing me. So without further ado, let me turn it over to Melissa. Here you go.
Great. Hey, Tim, welcome. And it is always interesting to be on the other side of the table, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah. Here we go.
All right, let's do it. So we'll start out, even though we've already sort of introduced ourselves in the previous session, but I think it's good to have these stand alone a little bit. So let's review that we both were in which college?
The greatest college Yale has ever had. That's Morse College. Which Indeed. Is home to a pizza oven now, which I'm very bitter that we didn't have. But
we always had good food there. And it's interesting that in the last few years or however long, the Morse reputation for its excellent food has only increased. And I agree, a pizza oven would have been nice, but what can you do?
There we are.
All right. So tell us about where you live now, what's going on with you, just a general background of your life as it stands.
Sure. So I'm married to our classmate, Lisa Vigliotti Harkness. Lisa was in
Brantford. Yes, we're going to get into that in a bit.
Well, Lisa was in Brantford. We live in Greenwich, Connecticut. I work, I have an office in Manhattan, haven't really been there in a while, but work as a lawyer in Manhattan for an international law firm and do international litigation. We've got 4 kids now. We have one in medical school, one who's just graduated from college and lives in Boston, one who's a first-year student in college, and then one who's a senior in high school and doing the college application process now.
So you are getting very close to empty nesting, which will be very exciting.
We are getting very close. The dog is very excited about more time with us. She has enjoyed the pandemic, I will tell you.
Well, speaking of the pandemic, I know it was hard on all of us. It was very dislocating. I mean, obviously, you've set up in your home office here, which is fantastic. You also got and recovered from COVID early on. You were an early adopter, as with so many things.
That's right, yeah. Yeah. That last day, I was like, oh, I'm going to clean the stuff out of my office so I have my papers. Lisa's like, don't go in. It'll be fine. You'll get back in a couple of weeks. And of course, I went in on the train, got COVID a few days later, and then we were off to the races.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you recovered fully and everything turned out okay with that.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I'm too. Yeah,
being in New York during that time was particularly stressful. It's a pre-vaccine time and hard to even remember somehow like how scary that time really was. So
yeah, it was a little crazy. I was hunkered down in our bedroom alone and they would drop meals off 3 times a day and I'd have to race the dog to the door because she was on the other side of the door. They'd put the food on a chair and whoever got to the chair first got to eat that meal. So
pretty good. What was your average in terms of getting?
I was pretty good with the dog and I came to an understanding.
Well, I could see how she might want to spend more time with you when the kids are gone.
That's right.
The competition's not as swift as
that's right.
The younger ones. So, well, that's great. So thinking about COVID a little more, I know it looms so large in our experiences at this point. We can't really get away from it. Have there been silver linings for you in terms of your life? You're working at home. There have been other things that have been unexpectedly good about having a different way of being in the world?
Well, it was funny. We did a bunch of house renovations right before COVID. So we had like we were preparing for it. No, obviously. But yeah, we had all the kids home, which was really fun. I enjoyed that. For the first few weeks, I was still up in my bedroom, so I didn't get to see them. I heard them. They were having a good time. But then, you know, we had a few months where everyone was back, and that doesn't happen very often. So we enjoyed that. I spent more time having dinner together. Because usually with my commuting, I would get home way after everyone was done with dinner. And to be able to sit down and eat meals together with whoever was in the house has been really a nice part of it. Sunday dinners are a big part of our family traditions and really important part of connecting. And being able to do that every night has been something I've really enjoyed. And I'd say, even though I'm getting a little tired of Zooms and Teams and Google Meets, whatnot, being able to reconnect with people because I have been speaking to my roommates more, seeing them on the screen, figuring out what's going on people's lives. The more Zooms that you've been doing have been great. So in that way, I've been connecting with more, not more people, but more people from different parts of my life. And I've found that to be a really good thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, I have to agree. The reconnection with people has been, people that are far away or even close by that you couldn't see, has been one of the best things about this whole situation we found ourselves in. So let's go back a little, though. You know, this is a Yale podcast. We're promoting our reunion. Mm-hmm. So even though we've managed to reunite after in the new way, which is not to all traipse to campus every 5 years and actually get together, we're doing it more often, which is great. But let's think back, oh, so long ago, you and I met the first day of school.
We did.
Like on old campus, you know, there we were. I'm really interested. When I met you, obviously, you know, you've got, I thought you had a big tower named after you and, you know, like... You were in, baby. And I'm like, what's a kid like me doing here? But it turns out that really wasn't the case. And so I'm interested in why, you know, a kid from Michigan with a long history of going to Michigan, the University of Michigan, why, how'd you end up at Yale?
Well, it actually turned out as a family joke. That's really how it all started. So we took a big family road trip out east from Detroit in, I'm pretty sure it was 1976. I can probably go verify the date.
A bicentennial trip. You're going to see America.
It was a bicentennial trip. And, you know, we went over Niagara Falls and went to Ticonderoga, went to Boston. And then we were driving from Boston to New York to visit our cousins who lived in northern New Jersey at the time. In any event, we're driving down the street and we see this big sign that said Harkness State Park. We're like, oh, that is hysterical. We've never met anyone else named Harkness and didn't know anything about the Harkness legacy out east, didn't know anything about that. We thought it's hysterical. There's a picture of me and my siblings in front of the sign on I-95 to Harkness State Park. And then, you know, we see that there's like a Harkness Tower at Yale. So we thought that was pretty funny. And so the joke became, oh, when the time comes to apply, of course, you're going to apply to Yale, and among other things. And it wasn't really a very serious consideration, I have to say. I mean, I went to an all-boys Catholic school, and so Georgetown was my number one.
Yep.
Although I was recruited to swim at Yale, and so I was talking to the swim coach from time to time, but hadn't really given it a whole lot of serious thought. My attention was at other schools. And then when I got admitted, came out and visited, and I'm like, wow, this is something. So there I was. So it really became, like I said, started from a family joke going down I-95.
Wow. Well, the joke's on the family, huh? turned out pretty well for you.
Yeah, that's right. It was a joke of my parents.
And your oldest son, who's followed in your footsteps. Yeah. Very nice.
It was a joke of my parents is that, yeah, I got admitted to the University of Michigan Labor Day weekend because I used to have rolling admissions. Yep. So I applied in August. So like the first day of class, my senior year of high school, I was already admitted to the University of Michigan. It's like, okay, I can't lose in this.
That's right. You're good. You're going to college.
That's right. And so, like, you know, joke was on my parents because they didn't get in-state tuition.
They did not. Yeah. Yale is not in-state tuition, definitely. So thinking back again, obviously you met and married your college sweetheart. You did a lot at Yale, but what are your kind of fondest memories of some of those times, like when you really think about that experience?
You know, I think my fondest memories are just meeting all the people. I remember really at the very beginning of freshman year, meeting all these very different people. For me, I came from suburban Detroit to college, but when I was much younger, I lived downtown Detroit in a very diverse neighborhood. And we had all this freedom when I was little. I used to walk to school through a park when I was in kindergarten, which I know would never happen now. But my friends were all sorts of different kinds of people. And then later in, I think it was like third or fourth grade, we moved out to the burbs and everyone was the same.
Right.
And I'd really missed the vibrancy of my experience as a younger child. And I didn't really get that until I went to college, and to meet all these different kinds of people from all these different kinds of places was really the highlight. And it started the very first day, just meeting everybody. Right. I was really, everyone who knew me knew I was a pretty social person. So, you know, I spent a lot of time talking to people. I just love going to the dining hall and hearing what people were doing and just finding out all the different things people were into. I thought it was, for me, that was the big highlight.
You did have a nickname that reflected that.
That's right. Well, I'm a pretty jovial fellow. That was a swimming nickname that started. Everyone called me Happy starting when I was like 13 or 14 years old. So that carried through college and some people still call me that. I don't introduce myself in court as that, but.
Well, you know, depends on the case, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes you need the little edge, right?
Yeah.
Well, speaking of court, you know, it seems like you had a pretty direct path to law school. And did you always know you wanted to be a lawyer? Was that your plan on entry, or how did that happen?
Well, actually, I didn't have a direct path at all. So I had I'll say I was encouraged to go to law school early on. My mother's father was a judge. He had started a law firm with his law school roommate. His partner ultimately became the mayor of Detroit. And my grandfather was the chief counsel for the city of Detroit, and then was later the chief judge for the recorder's court in the Detroit court system. And my father is an attorney. So my mother really, really, really wanted me to be an attorney. So I really, really, really didn't want to do that just because she wanted me to do it, of course.
Of course, you wanted to forge your own path, right?
That's right. So, you know, after college, I went to New York, lived with John Barker and Cole Bidding, and, you know, had a couple different kinds of jobs. I was ultimately in PR, and then I wasn't enjoying that. And I saw that the lawyer had a much better job than I did. And so I decided, okay, I'm going to go to law school. But I decided a little late in the process. And so what I did instead is that I went and became a bike tour leader in France, did that for a few months, and coached swimming up in Vermont as well. And then ultimately got a job in the Michigan Senate as an aide and reestablished Michigan residency, because my goal was to go to the University of Michigan for law school, which I ultimately did. And then, so I worked as a legislative aide in the Michigan Senate and then went to law school. So that's how I got there.
Yeah, I think that kind of practical experience, you weren't quite as direct as I thought there.
There was nothing direct about me until I was probably about 25 years old. I was sort of like, okay, I wasn't as planned out. I wasn't as intentional with some of my life choices as I have been since. And part of it is just, I wanted to try all sorts of different things. And part of it was, I wasn't all that directed. So I became much more directed, I think, once I saw, okay, if I actually got a better job that was more suited to my overall talents, I would be happier.
Right.
And that's turned out to be true. I went to law school with a pretty clear idea of what I wanted to do New York style big litigation. And that's what I've been able to do. And I've been doing it now since 1995. And it's been a lot of fun. I mean, being a lawyer is a lot of hard work, but I've been really, really lucky to have great cases and have a lot of fun doing them. So, you know, I find myself to be like really fortunate in that regard and glad I meandered a bit, because I don't think law school is a good place to go find yourself.
Absolutely not.
It's a terrible place to.
No, I agree. So much better to try out other things and get some other life experience before you do it. I'm sure you learn more from being a bike tour guide in France than, you know, in some ways more than being a legislative aide, you know, like it's life skills.
Yeah, I learned a lot in both jobs, and I don't know if it's still on the books, but I did craft the part of the Michigan statute that allows you to use a municipal bond to build a grain elevator.
So nice,
I at least have that on my resume. But I learned a lot about, it was funny, I thought I wanted to go into politics until I worked in the legislature, and I thought, oof, I don't know if this is for me. And ironically, many years later, I did run for elected office in my town and served a couple terms in our town. It's called the town meeting, mm-hmm. the representative town meeting. So I've always been civically active, but I didn't want to make a career out of politics after I worked in it.
That makes a lot of sense. I think, like you said, you can't really know until you try it. And school is not really the best place to necessarily try out these life experiences. Like life is the best way to try that. So I think your meandering path was not meandering. It was,
that's right.
It was just the right thing. So I'm interested how you and Lisa decided to organize your family and your kids. I mean, you have a big family, right? You know, a lot of kids.
Yeah.
So did you have conversations about, you know, who was going to be on the train all day going to New York and working late and who was going to stay closer to home? Or was there any doubt about how that was organized?
No, we've talked about it over the years. We got married while I was in law school, and I got a clerkship coming out of law school in Brooklyn, but we decided to move to Greenwich at that point, and Tyler was born like 3 days after my clerkship was over.
Wow. That was tight timing there.
Oh yeah, it was. But no, we did. But you know, we've thought about what law firms would I interview in. I didn't want to go to a downtown law firm, partly because I didn't want to get on the train and then get onto another train.
Right.
And technology's allowed me to work from home a lot more, which has allowed me to be more present. But you know, there've been times when the balance didn't go quite as it should. We've had times when I was really consumed with the work I was doing in a way that wasn't healthy for the family. So we've certainly talked about it. I had 1 year where I think I had three trials and said, okay, that's not a lifestyle that's sustainable. You know, for a lot of different reasons.
Well, I was married to a trial lawyer for a long time, so I do understand exactly what you mean. And when you're in trial, you have to be all in. You can't halfway do that. So it's kind of a seasonal adjustment. Kind of, if you're in trial, you're not in trial. That's kind of how you have to do it.
That's right. And we've learned that when I'm on trial, my trial's in New York, I just move out of the house. I have to focus on what I'm doing.
Exactly.
Any event, we talk about it. We don't always get the balance 100% right. But the other thing is, and I tell younger lawyers this a lot, how do you balance it all? You make choices about what you're going to do. So I was trying to count the other day. I've probably coached 9 or 10 different sports while my kids were in different teams because I like to coach, and it was a way for me to be involved in what they were doing. So that means that if I'm going to coach basketball or baseball or whatever it is that I'm coaching and work the job that I have, that means that there are certain aspects of the social life that just have to go away for a while.
Right.
You know, our children have brought us a great deal of joy just being part of their lives. So not having some of the other things we used to do, going to movies or plays and things like that as much as we used to, is just part of the deal. But I'd much rather be with the whole family than doing stuff like that. And as they've gotten older,
and your time's coming, right?
That's right.
You know, in another year, you'll have plenty of time for that.
Right. And they've also pursued other interests, things that I was never really into, like classical music. I didn't know that much about classical music until our kids started studying it and playing it. And so, okay, let's go and listen to that and hear things and hear what they're doing. You know, it's really been, I think that's been part of the funnest part about being a parent, is following their passions and their interests and listening to what they're interested in.
Absolutely. Yeah, it really does open your world a lot, I think.
Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you're enjoying the conversation. Please remember that this podcast is being brought to you by the 35th reunion of the greatest class Yale College has ever known, the great class of 1987. Our reunion will be in New Haven, Connecticut, June 2nd, 3rd, 4th, and 5th in Pearson College. We hope to see you there. Now, back to the conversation.
Let's go back, though. You mentioned that when you came to Yale, it was a really diverse population, kind of people from different places with different outlooks that you were looking at and getting to know, similar to when you lived in a more diverse place. And we talked a little bit about law firms and diversity and trying to make them be more inclusive of people from all different places and backgrounds and genders or not, and what's going on there. And I know that you've thought a lot about that and have been trying to work to make your law firm reflect the diversity of our community a little better. And how do you do that? You know, you've got this big firm. It's almost like, you know, you can't turn on a dime when you got a firm that big. It's hard to change the traditions and institution of what you're doing, the function. Yet you seem to be making meaningful steps in that area. And I'm interested in how you're doing that.
Yeah, I guess there's a lot there. So let me try to take it one at a time. A couple of things. First of all, how did I get interested in this? You know, it was funny. We were at a hockey game and we're watching our nephew play ice hockey. And I don't know how old he was, 8. He was a little guy. And I've never seen kids play hockey. Like, they're just like pads wrapped in a jersey on skates. Everyone looks the same. And this kid, this child, skates by and has a ponytail hanging out the back. And our daughter, who's probably 7 or 8 at the time, turns to us and said, "Can girls play hockey?" And I almost fell off the chair. And I was like, "What are you talking about? Of course girls can play hockey." And we talked to her that night about her perceptions of the world. I'm thinking, your mother is executive at a high-powered place. Your aunt is an executive in a big company. You've met the judge I clerk for, who she had met, was a woman. Like, we have all these strong women in our lives. Like, how did she think this? It was, we listened and we heard all the different inputs that were coming into her perception of what was possible, realizing that some of the things we thought we were teaching in our home weren't connecting, and some of the messages that were coming from outside of our home were connecting in a very terrible way. And so we've tried to address that much more intentionally with family. And she did start to play ice hockey, by the way.
Wonderful.
She ultimately gave it up.
But she did become a math major in college, right?
Oh, so yes.
She did all kinds of stuff.
Yes, we're very proud of all of our children. And I hope my daughters will agree that they don't feel limited because they're women. And I don't want them to live in a world like that. But I realized I was missing the boat. So I started to talk to my female colleagues at work and realized, okay, I was completely missing the boat there too, because again, they were giving inputs that were different than the ones that I thought I was communicating and the firm was communicating. So I've spent a lot of time since then, and that's probably 15 years ago, making sure I'm reading the academic literature, the analyses, the reports about our profession, I can't change the entire world, but I can change where I work, right. Especially I'm a partner. So I should take responsibility for what it is I can do. So, you know, we do a few things. And I think that part of it is making sure that we are as objective and appropriate in the way we select talent, nurture talent, and that we're listening. So that's part of it. But I don't think real change comes unless you really have buy-in. I do some work in South Africa, and one of the firms I work with there went through a time of really immense change. And I asked one of the partners, how did you do it? We realized we had to change, and a bunch of us got in a room. We shook hands on what we were going to do, and we went and we did it because that's what we're supposed to do. And the people who wouldn't get on board didn't stick around. So I think very much personnel is policy. And I think that what makes me proud of my current firm is the fact that we're very intentionally putting leaders in place who are thinking about how we do what we do, how we provide services to our clients, who we hire, how we have an inclusive culture. And I think we're doing a lot better than a lot of our peers as a result. Are we doing everything perfectly? Probably not. If you look at the numbers in the profession, is a profession doing everything it could? Obviously not. So I think we have a long way to go. And I think that's part of what I would like to make the next, I don't call it 5 to 10 years of my career to be about, is making the firm that I work at and that the courts I work in and the process that I'm part of be more inclusive. Because that's, I think, really critically important. If I can't do it in my own little world, like how can I look my daughters in the eye? And how can I look my sons in the eye and say, this is the way you should live your life?
Well, your intentionality is amazing in that regard. And I really appreciate it. And I think it's unfortunately unusual to do a combination of kind of an academic approach, but also a really practical, people-centered approach to that. I think it's the only way it works. And I think it's only going to change when people like you and big firms, you know, big law starts to take a kind of a leadership role in terms of modeling what it's supposed to look like so that it can trickle down a little bit to everybody and to the courts and to the whole legal profession. So greatly appreciate that. Yeah.
Part of it is self-preservation. I mean, to be honest, I think it should be, because if you look at the trends, I thought the number I saw recently was like 58 or 60%. So over 50% of people who go to college are women. Mm-hmm. And then if you look at the law schools, the trends are going in that way. And then if you look at the people who are doing the best at law schools, look at our applicants, like the talent is very diverse. And if at the end of the career path, we've eliminated all the diversity, we only have this one set of people who look all the same.
Yep.
We've really missed the boat. And the other thing is, I think that people have always hired, I think, in their own image. And if you can redefine what your image is of yourself, and say, okay, it's not just about my gender identity or my race, my ethnicity, the school I went to. It's about a set of attitudes about hard work, intelligence, analysis, devotion to client. If that's how I define myself, then I should be able to find those qualities in a lot more people. And quite frankly, my organization will work better because I have people who are much more like-minded than superficially similar.
I love that redefinition. It sounds like it's effective and also very transformational in terms of your own perception of yourself and society and in your firm and everything like that. So I love that. Are you doing like continuing education classes to pass it along, or probably your firm again is big enough that just tackling that is enough? But it does seem like an interesting approach to equity and inclusion that we don't usually use, you know, or two.
You know, I haven't done a CLE about it, continuing legal education webinar. I'm trying to be a little bit careful about not mansplaining everything.
Thank you. I do appreciate that.
Yeah. No, but I do go to review meetings. I do participate in analyses of whether or not people are appropriate partner candidates or good lateral candidates. And I think if you put these kinds of thoughts and actions on the table throughout the process, if you think about who you're assigning to certain opportunities, who you're introducing to clients, who you're making room for in the partnership, Lisa says, you know, people aren't made partner, they're pulled into the partnership. And I think that's absolutely right.
Yeah.
And so if I think about mentoring relationships that way and thinking about making room for different kinds of people and opening my mind to why a person might be struggling if at the beginning of the career they're struggling. Maybe it's about them, but maybe it's not about them. Maybe it's about me, or maybe it's about the firm. And trying to be a little bit more intentional, or a lot more intentional about those things, can have a bigger impact, because nothing succeeds like success. And I mean, that's sort of trite to say. And what do I mean by that? I mean that if you set the junior people up for success, when they get to the point where we start to lose women, we start to lose lawyers of color, you can just look at the statistics. You know when it happens. It happens right. About...
It's just a drop off, yeah.
Yeah, about 5 years out of law school, it just starts. And okay, if they feel that they're part of an organization and they have a serious career path, they're not going to just walk out.
Right.
Now, so maybe they're going to say, okay, law firm's life, not for me, which is fine. But then, okay, let's work and try to help you get to where you're going to go. Maybe it's a non-governmental organization. Maybe it's a pro bono organization. Maybe it's a client. Then we have a long-term relationship and the profession is healthier. You didn't fail. You just made a different choice. And it's part of the ecosystem of the firm.
Yeah, and you don't feel like your investment was for nothing either.
Right. But then everybody else realizes, okay, if I do good work, even if things aren't perfect that first assignment, the firm's going to nurture me and help me. Then other people will know I can come here. And so We now have more openly gay colleagues because they know that they can feel comfortable. They're going to be accepted. And I would just want to work in a place like that where people, not that their sexual orientation is directly going to be relevant to me, but if they feel comfortable, then I get to keep talented people who are interested and quite frankly, fun to be around, whoever they are. If everyone's exactly the same, our work's not going to be as good and the workplace isn't going to be as fun to be in.
Yeah. And people are the best at being themselves. They're not the best at pretending to be you or me or anybody else. So if that can be, you know, if they can really be their best selves, then that is how you succeed. And I really applaud you for embracing that, because I think those early years, particularly when people, if you feel comfortable talking to the people that are giving you the assignments or who are very senior to you, and they see you as a person rather than just a little cog in the wheel. We talked about that before. I think that makes all the difference, you know, early on.
Oh, completely.
In terms of confidence and being realistic about what skills you need to learn.
Yeah.
All right. We are quickly running out of time here. I can't believe this. You and I could just talk for days, apparently.
Yes.
We can just do this. I guess we're going to have to go to the speed round because we're that short of time.
Here we go.
All right. So I'm modifying it a little bit because we didn't hit everything I wanted to talk about. But question one, favorite class at Yale. What was it?
Oh, it's got to be Mambo.
Mambo. All right. A classic.
It's the only class that got me a job. So not only was it, I really enjoyed it. And like, serious answer here, the answer is still Mambo. Because he used an integrative, Master T had used that integrative approach of looking at history, art, music all together.
Yeah.
I just thought looking at the world more holistically was much better. So years later, when I was applying for the legislative aides job, it was between me and one other person. And that guy had a political connection that I did not. So it was like final question. And the legislator who I worked for collected African art. And the last interview question, interview question we both got was, what do you think of that? And he pointed to a piece of art in his office. And the other guy had no answer. And I knew what it was, where it was from, what the iconography meant. And it all came back. And
that is amazing.
So History of the New York Mambo, Microcosms and Black Creativity is the only class I've ever taken that actually resulted in employment.
That is incredible. All right. Question two. This will be easy. Is Die Hard a Christmas movie?
Die Hard a Christmas movie? You know, it is, because at the end of the day, it's about family in sort of a, you know, twisted Bruce Willis kind of way. So I'm going to go with yes.
Good answer. I like that. All right. And then our final question that we just cannot avoid, Sally's or Pepe's?
I had Pepe's this weekend because I thought this question might be coming. And so,
you had to do a little taste test to prepare.
I did a little taste. I was going to go to Sally's too, but Sally's had a longer line. You know, I got to say, historically, I've been a Sally's guy, and Sally's has this brand new tent right next to it. They took a parking lot and made like a tent, like a beer hall kind of deal. It's awesome. I really want to go. But at the end of the day, you know, if push came to shove, it's going to be the Pepe's clam pie for me.
There you go. The classic.
Yes.
All right. Well, this has been fantastic. Like I said, we could have gone on for hours and hours here, but I really appreciate your taking the time to tell us all about your life now and before. And like I said, it's been great. And I really hope people will come to the reunion and meet in person, much as we enjoy speaking, you know, with little thumbnails on the screen. Because I think sometimes we feel like, oh, I can't remember that far back, or, you know, do those people even remember me? And, you know, do I have any connection there? And I think we really do. And I think it's a really nice thing to come and see people. And after being so separated for so long, I think it's a tremendous opportunity for all of us to come back and reconnect with the person and the place and just everything. So I hope we'll, I know you and I will be there, but I hope,
we'll see lots of
our classmates.
I hope so too.
Back in New Haven.
Sounds good. Well, thanks so much.
All right. You're very welcome. The pleasure was all mine.
A world where people were isolated by a pandemic, forced to live their lives remotely in an endless parade of Zoom meetings. One Yale College class dared to break the mold. The Yale College class of 1987 is planning what no Yale College class has ever tried before, at least not for a while. An in-person reunion, June 2nd, 3rd, 4th, and 5th, 2022. We will be gathering in Pearson College. Be there for engaging discussions, nightly revelry, and way too much New Haven pizza, if there ever could be such a thing. We'll wrestle with age-old questions like, maybe I look better in a mask, what do you think? Who or what is a Bula? What in the world am I going to do with no kids in the house? These questions and more will be answered at our 35th college reunion. Be there. That's it for today. Thanks so much for tuning in. This has been the Y87 podcast, the official podcast of the greatest class that Yale College has ever known. We hope you've enjoyed it. If you have any comments or questions or would like to appear as a guest, please email me at timothy.p.harkness@gmail.com. We look forward to hearing from you.